Good day, big boys and girls, parents and grandparents, teachers, and everyone interested in AI and robotics. I'm Anastasia, and I'm bringing to your attention AI snacks with Romy. By the way, this is the real Romy. And Robbie, a podcast for AI muggles, not wizards. Together with my guest and with my furry muse and AI influencer cat, I am translating AI and robotic technologies from difficult to easy to understand, and we are in the second year of the show looking at underlying machine learning technologies and discussing big themes such as AI in writing and education, AI in media and in content development, AI in the history of neuroscience, and AI in arts. Today we are going back to school. And we are talking vectors. And this is one of the most important techniques and methodologies for a variety of STEMs, such as math, geometry, physics, computer science. Vectors allow AI systems to represent various types of data in a format that machines can easily process. And for example, in image processing, vectors represent pixel intensities. And this allows models to analyze patterns and shapes. And it's really important to understand vectors, even if you aren't a computer scientist. You might be using a variety of applications or looking into the ways to introduce AI into your company or in your educational course. So it's important to understand vectors because those are to be found in a variety of areas, from computer vision to search, from classification to generative AI, and even large language models. And I won't be talking vectors to myself or to my cat. My guest today is Ilya Mazin, and he's vice president at one of my favorite companies in the world, and this is Dun & Bradstreet. Dun & Bradstreet is one of the oldest American companies, and Abraham Lincoln, a famous U.S. president, was once an employee at Dun & Bradstreet. So Ilya works as a vice president for data science, and he works across different domains from pattern classification and fraud detection to social listening and text synthesis. His influence extends beyond his role at Dun & Bradstreet. For example, he participated in briefing for the presidents of National Security Telecommunication Advisory Committee on Big Data Analytics. And he contributed to a white paper on big data for the Chinese State Council. So, Ilya, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I love your introduction, and it's very hard for me to compete with Romy, but I will give it a shot.
No one can compete with the real Romy, but yeah, he's a cat, so he's perfect. We aren't. Before we go into vectors, I would love to ask you a question. How did you end up working in data and big data and data science?
I ask myself that question every single day. So I'm not what you'd call a classically trained data scientist. I don't have a degree in quantitative disciplines. My degree is actually in philosophy. And then I went into management consulting for many, many years. I never specialized in, a lot of consultants specialize in an industry or enterprise domain. I kind of never did. So I kept hopping around and around. And then I came to D&B, kind of did a very similar thing, hopping across different enterprise areas. And then I was very lucky to land in data science, working for a chief data scientist at the time. And I really loved it. It's just kind of like you get to do things that are really at the edge of what is possible with computers today. So this is the first time that I actually stayed in something for a long time. And I don't see myself exiting the field.
And this is so cool. And this is actually one example that you don't necessarily need a huge history in studying statistics and computer science to work in machine learning and AI. And when we started discussing what could we bring on this program, we could have talked about remote computational interface and all kind of databases and statistics, but we decided to talk vectors. Could you remember when was the first time when you started kind of, you know, dealing with vectors? So I reveal, I think I was in 10th grade and it was my geometry class.
Yeah, that's about right, I would say. So even though, you know, like I agree, right? Like you don't need to have a PhD in statistics to work in data science, but it helps to have a little bit of math background, math or physics. So I went to a very hardcore engineering high school, and that's probably around the same time, 10th grade, 11th grade, that we've encountered vectors.
Yeah, and could you define what is a vector in AI and machine learning, and how could we maybe decode this term in an easy-to-understand language?
Yeah, I love it. And the reason I was so excited about talking about vectors with you is because I think a lot of people get really turned off and intimidated by this lingo, vectors and embeddings and tokens. And it sounds like, you know, there's this special caste that understands it. And everybody's like, in reality, like all these things, at least conceptually, are super simple.
Yes.
A vector is basically a numerical representation of something, an object or an entity or a concept. And so each object will have a set of attributes, and then you can assign sort of like size or intensity to each one of those attributes numerically. And then you end up with an array of numbers that looks like 1, 12, negative 1, 144, and you can go out many, 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 many thousands of dimensions. So just to make it a little more real, so I love this example because it's really silly. So take the word banana. Bananas have multiple attributes. There's a yellowness to bananas, and some bananas are greener, some are yellower. There's a sweetness element to bananas, right? Now, take a radish. So you could measure a radish on yellowness and sweetness. And of course, the radish will lose to a banana. So you take your, you know, so this is fourth grade math at this point, right? This is how simple it is. So you create a simple system of coordinates, the x, y, right? So let's say that the x axis is sweetness, from my example, and the y axis is my yellowness. So you could plot the banana and the radish into this two-dimensional, very simple space. And then the points that you got, if you connect the point of origin, 0, 0, to those two points, that's it. You created two vectors. You created a vector for banana. You created a vector for radish. And admittedly, this is a super, super, super simplistic, you know, semantic space, meaning space, but you have legitimately created two vectors. Congratulations.
This is wonderful. And why are those vectors so important for how machines understand and process information?
So this is really the crucial question. And we have to remember that computers work on ones and zeros, essentially, right? We're getting so spoiled with things like ChatGPT, where we can just basically say anything into it. You know, write a sonnet about vectors and AI, and these things do it amazingly well. Like Shakespeare would be jealous. So we're very spoiled by these very natural interactions with these systems. But in reality, it belies the fact that they work on ones and zeros. So, you know, when we were messing with bananas and radishes, like, again, like, computers don't understand banana. Like, they don't have a mental representation of a banana, right? So for you to do anything with computers and bananas, you have to represent bananas in a numeric format, which is, like we said, it's vectors. And once you do, so in that example, bananas and radishes, once you created those vectors, then you can start doing really, really cool and complicated things with them. You can analyze words, and you can analyze images or sounds. You can compare between them. You can calculate the degree of similarity. You can cluster things, like, you know, old yellow things. You can do math on them, like the banana vector plus brown vector equals bananas vector, right?
Yeah, rotten so, banana.
Yeah. So essentially, exactly, right? So essentially, vectors are a bridge between the raw data in the world, which is most of the time unstructured, right? So yeah. You know, text, images, whatever. So it's a bridge between that raw data and the language that computers can actually speak. So without vectors, we cannot do anything complex.
And it's really interesting just to remind ourselves that computers today in the digital world are all about zeros and ones and everything in between. So computers don't necessarily understand the way we do as human beings. Maybe can you reflect? So Andrei Karpathy, who built tons of AI technologies, said the next programming language is English.
That's right.
Yeah. How do you put this sentence into the context of those zeros and ones and what is going on today in computer science?
Yeah, so it's really interesting. It's a good way of putting it. So take large language models, essentially the technology that allows us to interact with computers using natural language, and they understand what we say and they generate language that are as human as anything that we generate. So like the example that we played with before, like bananas and radishes, it was great, but it was really, really too simple, right? Like bananas and radishes and everything else in the world have many, many thousands of different attributes, right? So I don't know, weight, cost, whatever, right? So for computers to truly understand English or any other language, you have to construct semantic vector spaces that are much more high dimensional than just two, right? Yeah. And in reality, like this is what large language models do. They represent words or even larger chunks of text as vectors in these very high dimensional spaces with hundreds or even thousands of dimensions. And then these vectors encode they encode like sort of like the basic properties of objects, you know, like weight, size, volume, shape, whatever. But interestingly, vectors can also encode very, very complex relationships between objects and that's a little crazy, but vectors can actually encode for how physical laws act on an object, right? So like, there's this example that kind of like floored everyone like a year and a half ago. So GPT-4, I think at that point, was able to solve the stacking problem, right? So take a bunch of random objects, a laptop, a book, a needle, tennis balls, whatever, right? A cat, if I may. A cat is not an object, so I apologize. And then the ask is, how do you stack those objects vertically so that the structure is stable, right?
Yeah.
And this kind of like blew everyone's minds because nobody had trained GPT-4 to stack things, obviously, right? And yet it solved that problem reasonably well. And the reason it can do it is because the vectors or the embeddings, like the other word for this term, they seem to contain some very, very deep truths about the world and how physical laws act on things, right? So from that knowledge that is like packed into the vectors, folded into the vectors, so these things know that if you try to balance a laptop, let's say like on one corner, well, it's incredibly hard because the center of mass is not aligned with the point, blah, 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 all that. So it's pretty crazy, but that information apparently is packed into these vector embeddings, and that's how computers make sense of of the world, whether it's images or when we can talk about images and sounds a little bit, but at least like this is how it works in with language. And that's why, you know, that sentence, like, you don't really need to know any more computing languages. So these things are getting so unbelievably good at understanding the world, the objects, the relationships between objects, that maybe that's true. Maybe like you don't really need to code anything anymore. Just say, hey, build me a game that does blah, blah, blah. In fact, like you already can today, kind of.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I am sometimes really, I'm wondering what we might learn when using AI more and more, and how those underlying basic methodologies in AI really find similarities and discover patterns unseen to us humans. And I think they are, this from one side, this seduction, being seduced by this fluency, those models apparently interact with us and with the words. And at the same time, we must remember they aren't us. They will probably never become us.
That's right.
They kind of look, and we are using human terms to describe what they do, right? They look at things differently. I remember reading a while ago a paper, I think it was by Google Brain, and it was about developing of machine learning models for eye doctors. And there was an interesting finding that AI clearly recognized eye diseases correctly on so and so many patients. But for example, for a human doctor, the gender of the patient doesn't play any role. An eye is an eye for a human doctor. But those models correctly identified male and female in the database. Though they were not asked to do this. And that wasn't an attribute to diagnose a disease. So I wonder, maybe there are some patterns which are hidden from us, which might appear on the surface maybe 10 years from now, and we will learn more and more and more.
But
how do you explain this? How do you explain how those vectors find similarities between different pieces of information?
So I think similarity is probably the most important word in this entire space. And I'm glad that the most important word is like a normal human word and not like, you know, embeddings or tokens. And that's because, so to get some utility out of this technology, you have to start focusing on people or enterprises, right, and their preferences, what they want to do, or, you know, what they care about. So when you talk about similarities, so we start comparing some theoretical canonical vectors of something and the vector that is very relevant for me, right? So let me talk a little bit about similarities. So again, like bananas, radishes, let's add one more word to that space. Let's say a canary, as in a bird. So your cat would be very pleased with that. I don't know if a canary would be. So, and let's say that the dimensions are, canaries are not sweet. So let's say the dimensions are yellow and size, right? So now you do the same thing. You create three vectors out of these words, and like canary is going to be very, very close to the canary vector is going to be very close to the banana vector, both in sort of like magnitude, how long the vectors are, but also in the direction, right? So the angle between the vector banana and the vector canary, the angle between them would be really, really small. And the length, the magnitudes would be pretty similar. Now, if you compare the vector of the canary and the vector of the radish, the magnitude is going to be very different, and the angle between them and this coordinate system would be like pretty large, right? So, and there are multiple ways to quantify the differences. It's cosine, similarity, dot product, blah, 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 whatever, not important, right? There's a way to calculate in a mathematical way how similar or dissimilar those vectors are. And that similarity can go between -1 and 1, where the similarity of 1 means the vectors are perfectly aligned, so very, very similar. 0 means they are as different as it can get. So in geometrical terms, they're orthogonal, right? And similarity of -1 means that they're pointing in a different direction, right? So, and this is really, it's pretty amazing, but this crazy space, that's how it works. Like whether it's, you know, comparing images or sounds or whatever, that's how it works. Like we just compare similarities. So like in imaging, right? So you could vectorize the concept of lung cancer, for example, right? So you can say, all right, what defines a lung cancer? So, you know, it might be size or, you know, how you can see the absorption, how the tissue absorbs the testing material, right? So you can come up with a vector of, this is the canonical image of lung cancer. And then when a patient comes in for imaging, you take their image, you calculate the vector using the same dimensions, and then you compare similarity of those vectors. And in this case, you really hope that the angle is very large between the two, right? Because that means like no cancer, right? And this is really how it works. Like, again, like, you know, all this, you know, large language models and imaging, and it's just like you create vectors in high dimensional spaces, like thousands of dimensions or whatever, hundreds. And then you find similarities between vectors, and that's really it.
If we talk now the advances in AI, so there is this concept of multimodal AIs. Mm-hmm. So using very different sources, so images and language and sound. How do you position the importance of vector technology there to find similarities between such different sources? And what are the latest trends there?
That's a really good question. To be honest, I haven't really done that much with multimodal stuff, so I don't really have a very good idea of how it happens, but you're right. And like, what's really interesting, all the largest large language models, you can basically assume that they have already ingested all the digital data that is ingestible, like the entirety of the internet and, you know, digital books and articles and magazines. So then you kind of have to ask yourself, like, all right, if we want more data, because these things for them to improve, you have to give them more and more data to train them on. So where does that data come from? And we all know that there's much more information contained in an image than in a block of text. So images are, to your point, it's an extremely information-rich medium. So how do people start combining like vectors that are sounds and images and text and all that good stuff? That's pretty interesting, because you could, in theory, combine the different dimensions, right, and create sort of like this hyper vector, right? I honestly don't know too much about what's being done in that space, but it's a pretty cool problem.
And what are your favorite applications? Maybe you're working on something right now utilizing vectors.
Sure. So here's a really interesting problem that we're solving, have solved. And this is the most exciting thing that's happening in my professional life. So if you think about the problem of search, right?
Yeah.
And let's just make it very real. Let's say we have a lot of customers that D&B has information on hundreds of millions of businesses globally, a lot of data, anything that you ever wanted to know. So we have customers who use this data to generate lists of companies subject to what they do. And it could be because they want to sell to them, or they want to use them as suppliers, or, you know, like even acquisition targets, right? So the way the space has traditionally functioned across the industry, right? So let's say you want to generate a list of prospects where companies do agriculture. So I'm going to pick something really wacky, like companies make drones for agricultural use cases, right? The problem that has always existed, typically the filtering to generate lists is done based on structured industry code taxonomies, right? So SIC or NAICS, and there's a bunch of taxonomies, right? the problem is these structured sort of like data dictionaries, if you will, become outdated very quickly. And, you know, like some of them are no longer supported. So they're really sort of like you read the industry codes. And it's like, wow, this is 1980s, right? And even if you have, if somebody's constantly maintaining them, so the ability to map a company to the right codes, you're essentially at the mercy of the person who's doing that translation, right? And if they're very good, great. If they're not very good, not great at all, right? So then the more sophisticated approach is sort of like more traditional natural language processing where you look for key terms, right? So, you know, like if you're, again, in this example, if you're looking for companies that make drones for agricultural use cases, so, you know, like you look for terms like drones, obviously agriculture, spraying, pesticides, I don't know, disease control, which is better than SICs. But again, like these key terms can become outdated very quickly. And again, like you're entirely at the mercy of the person who created that little list of things. So what we've been able to do now, we go to millions and millions and millions and millions of company websites. We figure out which information is the most important in terms of like truly knowing this is what this company does, right? And then we take that information and then we turn it into, lo and behold, vectors, right? So, you know, like there will be very long and complex vectors, but it doesn't matter. So it's a vector. So now we've taken what this company actually really does, not what, you know, somebody thought, how they map into a taxonomy. This is what they say they do. And now we represent it as a numeric vector. So when a customer comes and asks, give me a list of all the companies that make agricultural drones for agricultural use cases, we can turn the query into a vector as well. And then, bam, we're back to vector similarity, right? So once we've implemented that, I look at the results and it's very hard for me to believe how good they are. So it's something that, you know, there's a lot of hype about Gen AI and LLMs, and a lot of time, most of the time, probably that hype is very, you know, like people overestimate. But this is, to me, it's like it works miraculously well. So vectors in this problem space of search, I think it, you know, have allowed us to take a quantum leap in terms of the quality of the results and the precision and the match with what the question actually was asking.
Well, but that's actually the most important piece to truly understand the question and make the computers understand what is the exact question. So how do you formulate it? And then those magical vectors help you to decode the truth.
That's right. Exactly.
And of course, you That's started right. philosophy. Now we might get very philosophical and discuss what is the truth in this yeah. world. You know, what is the truth for this cat might not That's be the right. truth for us.
Yeah. So what's interesting to me, right? So, I've been around large language models and vectors and all this stuff for a while. So most of the time I just go through my day and I'm focused on, you know, like what needs to happen. I don't really think about these things, right? But every once in a while, I have this moment of, holy cannoli, how do they do this? This is yeah. amazing because, you know, in my example, the stacking example, like nobody has trained these things to stack objects, right? And so we talk about these moments where we see capabilities that were strictly not trained into the models. So we kind of talk about emerging abilities or emerging properties. And when I think about, you know, like where do these, how do LLMs have these emergent properties? So it really goes back to, you know, it's we take language and then we break it down into these very high dimensional spaces. And some of those dimensions really do encode relationships between words and how physical laws work. So I kind of have to like check myself as like, okay, this looks miraculous, but like this is how it works, right?
Yeah.
And what's like, there's some really deep, like you used the word truth, there's some really deep insights that come out of this realization. So one is, so human language has for a very long time been touted as something that separates us from every other living creature in the world, right? So by the way, nobody, like scientists no longer think that at all. Yeah. But so what's really interesting is LLMs to me have completely demystified human language, right? Because there's no magic sauce. There's no, you know, like anything. You take many, 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 many billions of words, push them through a neural net, which is, you know, a very advanced way of process information. And here you go. You have essentially distilled human language to this model. And this model contains all the knowledge that we have about the world. And here you go. And like you can this thing can generate language, like I said, like better than Shakespeare in some ways, right? So that's one really interesting realization, which is kind of ironic, right? Because the whole field of AI, some of the founders started AI because they wanted to understand the human language. But I think that still eludes us in a sense by, you know, like, yes, these things are actually, we still don't understand how LLMs work, but ironically, we are starting to understand a little bit about our brains, right? And then the second thing is, so I've been thinking about why these things seem miraculous to us. And I think there's just this basic like evolutionary biology, cognitive neuroscientific issue with our brains. As we evolved, like our brains never had to process really, really, really large numbers, right? So it was like, here's my little tribe and there's 100 people. And, you know, like in the last few days, we caught 3 animals. And so our brains have never had to deal with numbers that are larger than probably a few hundred, right? And when we work with these things, like we're talking about trillions of parameters in these models, our brains are just not equipped to understand how big a trillion is. Like the way, like I almost think that the way we actually process a trillion is as a very large thousand, right?
Yeah.
And that's sort of like the disconnect, right? Like these things seem miraculous because we can't process just how much information they contain and as a result, what that can do. And like, I was reading a book over the holidays about parasites, because what else would you read about during your holidays? And I had this idea that you have these like super simple, like in some cases unicellular organisms, and they're capable of hijacking their host's brain's chemistry, right? And they do unbelievably complex things. Like there's not unicellular, but there's some parasitic wasps that inject before laying larvae into the poor caterpillar to make sure that the immune system of the caterpillar doesn't kill the larvae. They inject a virus that is essentially like HIV, right? Like it destroys the immune system of the caterpillar and then they lay the larvae. So it's like, when I step back, it's like, oh my God, like how can this happen? Like it, like, without some sort of like a design or what. But again, we forget that this parasite is a result of billions, 4 billion years of evolutions and many, 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 many trillions of generations. And, you know, like, I don't know how many, you know, like octillions or whatever, like different variants of this parasite. So again, like our brains just like fail to comprehend the enormity of these numbers. And it's just like a kind of like I saw a very clear parallel to my own sort of like wondrous reaction to, but my God, I know how these things work, but like it just doesn't make sense. It's too clever. So I think that's where it comes from. We just don't, it's impossible for us to comprehend how much information is packed into these things. Sorry, that was
This is actually absolutely interesting and fascinating. And there are a couple of learnings from what you've just said. First, we should be just really humble about who we are and what we do, because we do what we do based on our evolution and the properties of our physiologies, right? But we are capable to understand that we might learn from something else. Or someone else.
Absolutely.
In the organic world, and actually in the world we are building with help of math and computer science and physics and our understanding about how the universe works, right?
Absolutely.
Just, you know, my last question, and really thank you once again for coming on this show.
My pleasure.
You know, there are several features, you know, several directions of work to improve current AIs. And work on vectors is one of those areas. So could you really very briefly talk about improving AI with vector technologies? What is going on there? And what are you mostly excited about in the area?
Yeah. So I think 2025 is going to be all about agents, autonomous AI agents, right? So to define agents a little bit for our listeners, agents essentially take, autonomous AI agents take very, very complicated problems and break them down into smaller pieces. And they're capable of reasoning and multi-step planning. And then they can use, you know, like digital tools if they need to. And so they can break down problems and create plans how to solve them. And this approach allows tackling use cases that are just way too complex and way too ambitious to just throw like a very, very smart LLM against. So like, again, like just an example from my life, we built and released a product called ChatDNB, and it talks to petabytes of DNB data, very, very, very diverse data. So if you set as your objective, you know, the customer can ask any question they want about this extremely diverse data, like today at least, like it doesn't matter how smart the LLM is, like if you just unleash the LLM on this problem, it's going to hallucinate like crazy. So it will make things up. So we created this autonomous agent framework where we broke the problem down by the types of data that we want to talk to. And then sort of like it's a matrix. So types of data and types of tasks, right? So like, you know, find the company in our database, like create a list of companies. And so because we're essentially breaking down this enormous problem into much smaller pieces, it just works much, 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 much better, right? And it's kind of interesting, right? Like, so agents, it really reminds me of that famous Gibson quote that the future is here, it's just unevenly distributed, right? So in 2023, like I found some data from a VC in the Bay Area. In 2023, of the companies that were doing any generative AI, 0% used agents or whatever. Yeah. It rounded to zero, right? We started using it in 2023. In 2024, the number is 12%, right?
Wow.
So I think this is really going to explode in 2025 because, again, like these things allow users to do things that are just not possible without it. So for me, I'm actually like, I'm the most excited about how agents will evolve and become more complicated. And actually, like last week, I had a fascinating conversation with Harrison Chase, the CEO of LangChain, and he has some really interesting ideas about the directions in which agents will go. And so one of them is, so today agents mostly enable sort of like chatty interfaces, right? So there's this idea that 2025, we'll really start seeing agents embedded in like things like, you know, Google Sheets or Excel or other productivity tools. And like, for example, an AI agent might autonomously analyze data trends in your spreadsheet and sort of like forecast sales figures and recommend next steps. And all that is like without, you know, you don't need to guide it. It's just like it's guided by what you're doing in the spreadsheet. So that's sort of like, you know, non-chat interface agents. Then ambient agents are going to be also like a much bigger thing in our lives. And ambient agents, it's basically they sit in the background of something and just like listen, right? And when they need to, so they don't work continuously, but they need, when they need to, they jump into action, right? So it could be like, you could define an agent to respond to your emails, right? Because most of your emails, you don't really need to engage with, right? And then the most fascinating thing, I think, like memory in AI systems. So it's kind of obvious, right? Like the more you allow these systems to remember about you, the better they can work with you, the more personalized your experience can be. So in my personal life, I have allowed OpenAI to remember all my conversations with ChatGPT, which gives me an incredible level of experience, right? Like just for kicks, I asked it, imagine you're an FBI profiler, create my behavioral profile. And when it came back, I was like, holy crap, this is incredible. And then I let my wife read it, and she, of course, was like, well, I don't need any fancy AI to know that your obsession with soccer is unhealthy. But if you allow these things to remember your preferences or what you do, of course, there's a big privacy downside. And, you know, if you're an enterprise, do you want someone to store a lot of sensitive data somewhere else? Not, you know, but the upside in experience is like pretty amazing. Just, you know, like imagine you're managing supply chain, and then you walk in the morning and there's an email waiting for you that says, hey, the CFO of your biggest supplier is indicted for financial fraud, which means you probably want to look into alternative. And here's a list of 10 companies that you could start from, rank ordered by, you know, like your company's needs and whatever, right? So it's a very, very powerful experience. Again, you're giving up privacy, and, you know, like how your information is governed is out of your hands to some extent, but the upside is huge. So I think, you know, like a lot of these things, we will see all these trends kind of like getting explored in 2025. And like the coolest thing about agents, and this is probably beyond 2025, like nobody says that the tools that they can use are only like software or APIs or digital tools. Right? So at some point, like it's unavoidable, we will see these agents actually control robots, right? So a robot is not this like individual thing, but it's actually controlled by an agent that is optimizing against, you know, higher level objectives. So it's really interesting. And at the end of the day, like again, like to bring it back to vectors, all that is really possible because, you know, we found a way to represent the world and how, you know, things and interactions between things. We have found a way to represent all those as basically like a set of numbers, what we started from, 1, 0, -12, whatever, right?
Yeah, that's absolutely. Yeah, Ilya, I can't thank you enough. And the ethical side of the equation is a very important one. We might spend another hour discussing this. So in my eyes, actually, what doesn't work is when you have a complete centralized world where everything belongs just, let's say, to two companies, right? And this is why addressing innovation in all kind of companies and helping them to work together to maybe build data trust to solve a certain problem, share APIs, share certain underlying technologies, invest into infrastructure. This is tremendously important. Yeah. And I am absolutely against just forbidding those technologies because we won't save anyone and solve anything just by over-regulating those, right?
I completely agree. Yeah. I mean, listen, you know, like we can't, there's some very, very serious and legitimate concerns, right? Like I'm not, you know, like I'm not an AI alarmist. Like I don't really believe in sort of like, you know, Skynet, Terminator scenarios, right? It's really interesting. Like to me, so one of my biggest influences is Charlie Munger. And Charlie always said, like, read stuff outside of your domain because it will give you frameworks, like these mental frameworks. So I think like I keep coming back to evolutionary biology again and again and again as I think about AI, right? So the reason I don't really believe in these Skynet sort of like, you know, apocalyptic scenarios is like, why would an intelligent AI, if we ever get there, like, why would it try to control humanity? Like this instinct to control and protect itself is an evolutionary instinct that has evolved in biological things over billions of years, right? So like AI will not have it, right?
Yeah.
So it's really interesting to think about it. What would it actually do if it's not instructed to do anything, or even when instructed? So it's kind of like, well, if I have no impetus built into me to do anything, then I won't do anything, right? So it's really interesting. But, you know, there's a lot of kind of like high level philosophy, but your point is extremely important, right? Like, we don't want to shut these things down because, I mean, my God, the advancement in medicine that these things are going to produce, it's just
chemistry, biology.
Right?
Yeah, right. Absolutely.
There's a great book by, I think, Paul Jarre, The Army of None, about autonomous weapons, right? That's probably where I get off the bus, right? Like,
yeah.
That's probably a little bit too autonomous for me. So it's, you know, it's a really interesting problem where we draw the line and allow these autonomous behaviors and where we say, ooh, that is a little bit too much. So,
yeah.
It's a big, big topic in AI ethics.
And by the way, I'm really surprised that this cat stayed for the whole conversation. He has never done.
He knows that he has a cat person on the other side.
No, I let him go now. And thank you once again. And by the way, once again, study philosophy, people. And you might end up in data science and really contribute to the field because you will have a very different perspective, very holistic approach at how you analyze problems and think about the future. So just for my listeners, I am hugely interested in understanding how sci-fi authors see AI and robots. And I actually wrote to a number of those to bring them on my show because I just want to understand their perspective and where their inspiration is coming from, what they study and what they see. And combining school math, more advanced math, physics, computer science, and then humanities, hopefully, will bring us better, beneficial and more transparent AIs. And with that, I would like to close today's episode. So he is once again Romy and the Secrets of Sleep, the very first volume of the Romy and Robby series, available on Amazon.
Buy the book. I did. It's fantastic. I'm really enjoying it, and I gave it to my almost 12-year-old daughter. It's really wonderful.
Oh, thank you so much. I mean, Romy was the inspiration, and actually, so this is how I painted him. So unmistakably Romy, and even without vectors. But thank you so much. And please visit the book website, www.romyandrobby.ai. Starting with May, we will have a small section on this website for, users. And there will be events for users like webinars and Q&As and more lectures on AI. And once again, Ilya, thank you so much.
Oh, my gosh. Thank you. It's been a wonderful, wonderful conversation. And
thank you.
I think you and I share this passion for making things that sound really complicated and out of reach.
Yep.
They're not. I think, you and I share this passion of opening the tent for many, many more people to come in and understand these technologies and therefore like benefit from them. So this is wonderful.
Yeah.
Thank you.
The more the merrier what we can learn from all of those people. So AI literacy and technology literacy is imperative for the world to develop. Ilya, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And goodbye. And I will see you again in 2 weeks.